We are doing some informal studies on Sunday evenings on the subject of revival. We've looked at revival from a biblical point of view, and now we're just considering it from a historical point of view, and we're working our way slowly but surely through the Great Awakening of the 18th century, or the Evangelical Revival, as it is known in the United Kingdom. Here in America, it's usually called the First Great Awakening. I hope to go on to one or two other historical revivals to tell you of before we're through. But this particular one is so thrilling, and I'm hoping that by these little snippets of history that I will whet your appetite to read for yourself. I put some books on the communion table here that relate to the Evangelical Revival. And particularly I recommend the two volumes on George Whitefield by Arnold Dallimore, who is a Canadian pastor, the biography of George Whitefield. You will not find it dry reading, but fascinating reading, and therefore I'm going to read from some of it. Do you remember last week we were looking at Whitefield's landing in Lewis, Delaware, preaching at White Clay Creek and Fags Manor? And also in Philadelphia, and his friendship that began with Benjamin Franklin, and Franklin estimating how many people really could hear George Whitefield preach, and he decided as a scientist that it was not exaggerated when newspapers reported that more than 20,000 people at a time could gather and hear the great evangelist. He said goodbye for the time being to Philadelphia, and when 20,000 people did gather to hear Whitefield preach on that occasion, it was probably the largest gathering of people in American history to that date. Mr. Dallimore tells us a little about a visit he made to Fags Manor, another visit which I will, if I can find the page, I'll read a little bit to you because it's local. It relates to the fact that the revival preachers often found that people not only came to Christ, but they sometimes became overcome with emotion, and that was one of the controversial aspects of the revival. Whitefield spent but 5 days in Philadelphia on this return visit, Wednesday to Sunday. The congregation at his farewell service was estimated at nearly 20,000, and this was undoubtedly the largest gathering in American history to that date. Saturday, May 10th, he says in his journal, this is Whitefield, "In the evening I went to a society of young women. As soon as I entered the room and heard them singing, my soul was delighted. When the hymn was over, I desired to pray before I began to converse. But my soul was so carried out that I had not time to talk at all. A wonderful power was in the room, and with one accord they began to cry out and weep most bitterly for the space of half an hour." Similar strong emotional effects accompanied Whitefield's preaching when, after leaving Philadelphia, he came into the area of White Clay Creek and Fags Manor. I thought I had a piece of paper here to tell you where Fags Manor is, but I don't seem to have it with me. Can anybody remember? You can remember where. It's a beautiful spot, and you can just imagine the great crowds that came from all over to hear Whitefield preach. So, he came to Fags Manor. At the latter place, the Reverend Samuel Blair was the pastor, and a few months before Whitefield's visit, he had witnessed a marvelous work of the Spirit of God in deep conviction and remarkable conversions. But strong outcryings occurred in connection with this work, and though Blair repeatedly urged his hearers to, quote, moderate their passions, but not so as to stifle their convictions, several would be overcome and fainting, others deeply sobbing, hardly able to contain. Word of these extraordinary events spread to the neighboring communities and brought people in excited throngs to attend Blair's services, and many of these folk, upon returning to their homes, waited and longed for further experiences of this kind. Such were the conditions that prevailed when Whitefield came into the area. At White Clay Creek, he reported, "One cried out most bitterly, as if in great agonies of soul." The following day he was at Nottingham, where he wrote, "Oh, what tears were shed and poured forth after the Lord Jesus. Some fainted, and when they had got a little strength, they would hear and faint again. Others cried out in a manner as if they were in the sharpest agonies of death. So this was one of the controversial aspects of the revival, and it led to Jonathan Edwards writing how to tell the difference between that which was just carnal and emotional and that which was really wrought of the Holy Spirit. And so he went to the Northeast, and he went to Boston. And let me read one or two other little bits to you about his visit to Boston. His final visit to the great city of Boston, the final day. Whitfield concluded his 24 days in the Boston area, including the one-week tour to the north, with a Sunday which God caused to be a day of jubilee. During its early hours, awakened souls, many more than he had time to deal with, came seeking him at his lodgings, but he had to leave them in order to go and preach at the Old South Church. Anybody ever seen the Old South Church in Boston? Yeah, I've been in there. Upon arriving, however, he found the crowd so great that he could not get in by the doors and was obliged to enter through a window. And that'd be a wonderful day when you couldn't get the preacher in here except through the window. He was unwell following the meeting, but went in the afternoon, driven by the governor in his coach, to the Common for his farewell service. Anybody ever been on Boston Common? Yeah. As soon as I go to these places, you know, I just imagine the revival and the Great Awakening and Whitfield. I have all this in my mind. It shows what you're interested in is what you think about when you go to different places. Apparently, the vast majority of the inhabitants of Boston were there, and many from outlying towns, for a newspaper reported, quote, there were at a moderate computation 23,000 present. Whitfield wrote in his journal, I preached my farewell sermon to near 20,000 people, a sight I have not seen since I left Blackheath. That's a place in London, used to be near London, and a sight perhaps never seen before in America. It being nearly dusk before I had done, the sight was more solemn. Numbers, great numbers, melted into tears when I talked of leaving them. I was very particular in my application, both to rulers, ministers, and people. After sermon, the governor went with me to my lodgings. I stood in the passage and spoke to a great company, both within and without doors, but they were so deeply affected and cried so loud that I was obliged to leave off praying. The remainder of the evening was almost entirely spent in speaking to persons under great distress of soul. Blessed be God for what he has done in Boston. I hope a glorious work is now begun and that the Lord will stir up some faithful laborers to carry it on. Well, of course, the Lord did stir up faithful laborers to carry it on. Let me read a bit of one of them. This is after Whitfield had gone. This is the ongoing work. Now was such a time as we never knew. The Reverend Mr. Cooper was wont to say that more came to him in 1 week in deep concern about their souls than in the whole 24 years of his preceding ministry. I can also say the same, says Mr. Prince, the writer, the Reverend Prince, as to the numbers who repaired to me. Mr. Cooper has had about 600 persons in 3 months, and Mr. Webb has had in the same space above 1,000. They repaired to us both boys and girls, young men and women, heads of families and aged persons. Persons far advanced in years came, afraid of being left behind, while others were hastening to the blessed Redeemer. One historian summarizes these results saying, this wondrous movement continued a year and a half after Whitfield's departure from Boston. 30 religious societies were instituted in the city. Ministers, besides attending to their usual work, preached in private houses almost every night. Chapels were always crowded. The very face of the town seemed to be strangely altered. Even the boys in the streets left their usual rudeness, and taverns were found empty of all but lodgers, says a contemporary historian. Our lectures flourished, wrote Dr. Coleman in a letter to Dr. Isaac Watts. Our Sabbaths are joyous, our churches increase, and our ministers have new life and spirit in their work. Of course, Whitfield looked forward to going to Northampton. to meet with Jonathan Edwards, the Reverend Jonathan Edwards. You remember that Jonathan Edwards had seen a revival in 1735 particularly, in his church in that town, changed the whole face of the town and spread to surrounding towns, the great Jonathan Edwards. And so for Jonathan Edwards had written an account of that revival, a narrative of surprising conversions, which had been printed in England by Isaac Watts, and circulated in England and was read by John Wesley, and was very influential in the life of John Wesley and in the life of George Whitfield. So God linked together different branches of the revival, which of course was all his movement. And so we read of how he came to Northampton. Edwards' report of Whitfield's visit and of the results that followed indicate that Whitfield's prayer was answered. Says Edwards, Mr. Whitfield preached four sermons in the meeting house, besides a private lecture at my house. The congregation was extraordinarily melted by each sermon, almost the whole assembly being in tears for a great part of the time. Mr. Whitfield's sermons were suitable to our circumstances, containing just reproofs for our backslidings, and in a most moving and affectionate manner, making use of our great profession and great mercies as arguments with us to return to God from whom we had departed. And Mrs. Edwards, wrote a letter to her brother. Dear Brother James, I want to prepare you for a visit from the Reverend Mr. Whitfield, the famous preacher of England. He has been sojourning with us, and after visiting a few of the neighboring towns is going to New Haven and from thence to New York. He is truly a remarkable man, and during his visit has, I think, verified all we have heard of him. He makes less of the doctrines than our American preachers generally do, and aims more at affecting the heart. He is a born orator. You have already heard of his deep-toned yet clear and melodious voice. It is perfect music. It is wonderful to see what a spell he casts over an audience by proclaiming the simplest truths of the Bible. I have seen upwards of 1,000 people hang on his words with breathless silence, broken only by an occasional half-pressed, half-suppressed sob. He impresses the ignorant and not less the educated and refined. It is reported that while the miners of England listened to him, the tears made white furrows down their smutty cheeks. So here our mechanics shut up their shops and the day laborers throw down their tools to go and hear him preach, and few return unaffected. A prejudiced person I know might say that this is all theatrical artifice and display, but not so will anyone think who has seen and known him. He is a very devout and godly man, and his only aim seems to be to reach and influence men the best way. He speaks from a heart aglow with love and pours out a torrent of eloquence which is almost irresistible. I wish him success in his apostolic career, and when he reaches New Haven, you will, I know, show him warm hospitality. Yours in faithful affection, Sarah. And, of course, George Whitfield, who stayed in their home, was very impressed with the Edwards and their household. They had 11 children, you know. He says in his journal, felt great satisfaction in being at the house of Mr. Edwards. A sweeter couple I have not yet seen. Their children were not dressed in silks and satins, but plain, as becomes the children of those who, in all things, ought to be examples of Christian simplicity. Mrs. Edwards is adorned with a meek and quiet spirit. And he was so impressed with Mrs. Edwards that he wrote that he prayed that God would be pleased to send me a daughter of Abraham to be my wife. And then he said, preached this morning and good Mr. Edwards wept during the whole time of exercise. The people were equally affected, and in the afternoon the power increased yet more. Oh, that my soul may be refreshed with the joyful news that Northampton people have recovered their first love, and that the Lord has revived his work in their souls and caused them to do their first works. Remember that George Whitfield was only 26 years old when we're talking about all of this. It gives you a color for what it was like for the ordinary people of the day to go and hear Whitfield as he went from place to place. And remember that he made 7 visits to the United States, to America, as then called, and died here. To read of an unlettered farmer named Nathan Cole, who went to hear him in another place after he'd left Northampton and Jonathan Edwards. And the meeting was not unusual in any way for Whitfield, because he preached somewhere every day, and wherever he was passing through, they heard he was coming, and they gathered a crowd and asked him to preach. So he just says in his journal, "Preached to about 4,000 people at 11 o'clock. This was at Middletown. That's all he says. But one man wrote an account of it, this unlettered farmer, and here is his account. "Now it pleased God to send Mr. Whitfield into this land, and I longed to see and hear him. And then one morning, all of a sudden, there came a messenger and said, 'Mr. Whitfield is to preach at Middletown this morning at 10 o'clock. I was in my field at work. I dropped my tool that I had in my hand and ran home and through my house and bade my wife to get ready quick to go and hear Mr. Whitfield preach at Middletown and run to my pasture for my horse with all my might, fearing I should be too late to hear him, and took up my wife and went forward as fast as I thought ye horse could bear.'" There's no punctuation, by the way, in all of this. "And when my horse began to be out of breath, I would get down and put my wife on ye saddle," and I assume she must have been running alongside, "and bid her ride as fast as she could and not stop or slack for me, except I bade her. And so I would run until I was almost out of breath, and then mount my horse again, fearing we should be too late to hear ye summon, for we had 12 miles to ride, double, in little more than an hour. I saw before me a cloud or fog. I first thought of from ye great river, but I came nearer ye road, and I heard a noise, something like a low rumbling thunder, and I presently found out it was ye rumbling of horses' feet coming down ye road, and this cloud was a cloud of dust made by the running of horses' feet. It arose some rods into ye air over the tops of ye hills and trees, and when I came within about 20 rods of ye road, I could see men and horses slipping along. It was like a steady stream of horses, and their riders scarcely a horse more than his length behind another. I found a vacance between 2 horses to slip in. My horse and my wife said, 'Law,' and my wife said, 'Law, our clothes will be all spoiled. See how they look.' And when we got down to ye old meeting house, there was a great multitude. It was said to be 3,000 or 4,000. And when I looked towards ye great river, I see ye ferry boats running swift forward and backward. When I see Mr. Whitfield come up upon ye scaffold, he looked almost angelical, a young, slim, slender youth before thousands of people and with a bold, undainted countenance. And my hearing how God was with him everywhere as he came along, it solemnized my mind and put me in a trembling fear before he began to preach. For he looked as if he was clothed with authority from ye great God, and a sweet solemnity sat upon his brow. And my hearing him preach gave me a heart wound. And by God's blessing, my old foundation was broken up, and I see my righteousness would not save me." So a simple man writes of just one typical example of the thousands and thousands, hundreds of thousands, who heard Whitfield and the Wesleys and many other preachers. We've heard of those who remained in Boston, saw the great blessing. So although God has his instruments, some were more prominent than others. Jonathan Edwards, you would hardly believe, but was voted out of his church from the pastorate in 1750 because he insisted on a converted membership. And it became a dispute in the church. Until the end, they voted the pastor to leave. And so he took a pastorate at Stockbridge on the border of Massachusetts and New York, a frontier place, very rustic, and set himself to preach to the Housatonic Indians and to pastor a group of converted Indians. He had been greatly moved by the life of David Brainerd, minister and missionary to the Indians in northeast Pennsylvania, who died when he was only 29 years old, but whose journal became a devotional classic that was mightily used in the life of many missionaries and still is to this day, and his life that was written about by Jonathan Edwards also. So he went to the Indians. And some people might have said, what a waste, after that great influential pastorate that he had, and after all that he had seen and done in that town, he could have been bitter. But he was not. And God was in it all, because it was during his time at Stockbridge that Jonathan Edwards wrote some of his greatest works. So just as Bunyan, who was 12 years in prison in Bedford Jail in England, laid aside seemingly, was nevertheless busy writing. And his writings we still have to this day. Grace Abounding to the Chief of Sinners, Pilgrim's Progress, and so on. So it was with Jonathan Edwards. He was appointed eventually president of Princeton in 1757, and he went to take up his appointment. But he died of a smallpox vaccination in 1758 at the age of 54. George Whitefield preached 40 to 60 hours every week, 18,000 sermons, twice to Ireland, 15 times to Scotland, 7 times to America, and died in Newburyport, Massachusetts, September 29, 1770, at the age of 56. George Whitefield and his friend John Wesley had a difference of opinion theologically. By reading his Bible and reading the writings of some of the Scottish divines, George Whitefield had become convinced of what we sometimes call Reformed theology, or the doctrines of grace, or Calvinistic theology, doctrines surrounding the doctrine of election, whereas John Wesley was never so persuaded. So we had, on the one hand, the two great evangelists of the Great Awakening, on one hand a Calvinist, George Whitefield, and an Arminian, John Wesley. And it historically is an example of the fact that nobody has all the truth, and that God is pleased to use whom he will. And we should always respect those from whom we differ, because God may be pleased to use them just as much as us. One writer said that because of their love for one another, they made a mountain into a molehill, because they were very anxious that this difference should not divide them one from the other. But some of their followers were rather bitter in the dispute. So much so that a lady once asked George Whitefield, "Do you think, Mr. Whitefield, that we shall see John Wesley in heaven? Because he doesn't believe some things we believe, see." And George Whitefield said, "No, ma'am, I do not think we shall see John Wesley in heaven." She said, "Oh, I thought you would say that." He said, "I'll tell you why, because he will be so near the throne, and you and I will be so far away, that I doubt we shall ever see him in heaven." And John Wesley was George Whitefield asked that John Wesley should preach at his memorial service. And John Wesley said, "Did ever God raise up such a winner of souls as the great Mr. Whitefield?" The great actor of the day was the actor Garrick. In his carnal way, he just looked at the oratory of Whitefield and coveted it. He said that George Whitefield could say the word Mesopotamia and draw tears from a crowd, and that he would give 100 guineas to be able to say, "Oh, like Mr. Whitfield. John Wesley, who had thought that the saving of souls, and he himself said this as a high Anglican clergyman, had thought that the saving of souls almost a sin if not done in a church, was perhaps one of the greatest open-air preachers and evangelists the world has ever known. 250,000 miles on horseback. Preached 42,000 sermons. Coined the phrase, "All the world is my parish." Because, you know, the Episcopalian Anglican has to have a parish. Particularly in England, where the whole country is divided into parishes. So people challenged him, "What right have you to preach here? Go and preach in your own parish." And he said, "All the world is my parish." He died on March 2nd, 1791, at the age of 88. His last sermon, preached on February 23rd, just about 10 days before, "Seek ye the Lord while he may be found. Call ye upon him while he is near." John Wesley, with his writings, his published journals, his published books, had seen thousands and thousands of pounds go through his bank account. And when he died and his estate was all totted up, I believe he left £10. Because as much as he received, he always gave away. We'll come to this awakening for the last time next Sunday night and look at the results of the awakening. And I think you'll find them very, very interesting.